The harvesting of aquarium fish is an emotional topic in Hawaii, with conservationists and commercial fishers often pitted against each other. Last month, the Hawaii Circuit Court issued a ruling that placed a significant restriction on the commercial aquarium fish industry in Hawaii. And on Tuesday, we spoke with an attorney from the nonprofit Earth Justice for an explanation of the ruling. The discussion generated as many questions as it did answers, so our producer, Ryan Finnerty, called the Department of Land and Natural Resources Division of Aquatic Resources Administrator, Dr. Bruce Anderson, to get the facts on the aquarium industry in Hawaii.
The aquarium fish trade in Hawaii is probably one of the best managed fisheries anywhere in the world. It's particularly been a problem in West Hawaii in past years. In fact, the West Hawaii fisheries replenishment areas and other areas where aquarium fishing is prohibited was established decades ago to reverse the decline in the fishery in the Kona area. In the past, I think it has been a significant problem, but over the last few years, with these new regulations and what we're doing, our survey data has shown that the fishery is not only steady and sustainable, but it's also the fish that are caught most, yellow tangs and koli, are actually increasing in number as a result of the management measures that have been taken. So I think if there's a perception that we're not doing things well, those are past perceptions that I think are mistakenly promulgated by plaintiffs in this case and Kautza and others. I think we're really, we've done a lot over the last few years in particular to better manage the fishery.
So how does the department issue permits, commercial permits, for someone to go and harvest these fish and then sell them commercially?
The department issues a permit to use a fine mesh net to those who are interested in collecting fish commercially. In addition to that permit, there's also a need for a commercial marine license, which is also issued by the department. That costs $50 now, and that requires reporting of whatever they catch for commercial purposes. But everyone who's selling aquarium fish or other animals for the aquarium trade needs to have a commercial marine license. So in effect, you need both permits, the permit to use the small mesh net and the commercial marine license to sell fish in Hawaii.
Bruce, we spoke to Earth Justice attorney Summer Kupau Odo earlier in the week on this program, and I just wanted to play a clip for you of what she said concerning permits to harvest aquarium fish.
Hearing that we had in the circuit court, the attorney general shared some information from DLNR, and it was at that time 231 active permits. So we're looking at anywhere between 200 and 300 commercial permits, each allowing for the take of fish in unlimited amounts at any given time.
So, Bruce, two questions for you. Can you tell me how many permits are, before the recent ruling, how many permits were active in the state? And then following up to that, what types of catch limits are associated with those permits?
When the decision was made by the Supreme Court, and I believe that was back in September, there were about 230-something permits that were active. Permits are issued for a year, and they have to be renewed every year. Those were permits to use a small mesh net. There are far more commercial marine licenses out there. We require a commercial marine license for anyone who catches and sells fish, whether they're for the aquarium trade or for sale, for eating. And there are about 3,400 or so commercial marine licenses out in the state. There are fewer now because since the decision, we've stopped issuing permits. And because they're only valid for a year, some of those permits have expired. In the case of the aquarium fish, however, it's a moot question at this point, given that the court did order that we void all existing aquarium fish permits. So all the permits to use small mesh nets have been voided. So although the court didn't ban the taking of aquarium fish, it did ban the use of these small mesh nets, which are very important for the aquarium trade.
Okay, so you can still legally harvest aquarium fish. It's just the manner in which you do it that is now under scrutiny.
That's more or less true. There's a nuance on the Big Island where they have a special permit required for West Hawaii, which is issued that is associated with the small mesh net permit. And there is some question as to whether people can catch any aquarium life on the Big Island, but certainly everywhere in the state, the use of the small mesh nets is now disallowed.
And Bruce Anderson, prior to the court ruling, when small mesh nets were permitted across the state, were there catch limits imposed by the DLNR, either by species or size of fish, or I know location is already regulated, but was there anything when a potential fisherman was given a license that restricted the number of fish that they were allowed to take out of the ocean?
First of all, there is a restriction on the species that can be collected. There are hundreds of species of reef fish, and in West Hawaii, there are only 40 species that are allowed to be taken. These are fish that are typically popular in the trade, and fish where they're relatively plentiful. So there are significant restrictions on the number of fish that can be taken. There are bag limits for yellow tang on Oahu. I mentioned yellow tang because that's the fish that's most commonly caught for the trade. In fact, the two species of fish that are most often caught here in Hawaii and sold are yellow tangs and koli. They comprise, on the Big Island, they're more than 80% of the fish that are caught and sold. I focused on in West Hawaii a lot because that's where more than 70% of the industry is located. Obviously, we focus a lot of resources and attention on West Hawaii because that's where the industry is in large part. But there's a small industry here on Oahu that catches a variety of different fish, and that's not to be ignored. I should also add, the aquarium trade is not just about catching the fish. Invertebrates, the feather dusters, the shrimp, and other animals that are caught and sold comprise a significant amount of the fish or animals that are sold through the aquarium trade. In fact, about a third of the organisms that are sold for the aquarium trade are invertebrates. People focus on the fish because they're attractive and what most people think about when you think about aquariums, but there is a significant demand for other animals.
So, Bruce, what are those bag limits and how are the numbers determined by the DLNR?
Well, most fish, for example, in the fish in those 40 species, don't have specific bag limits. It's not really appropriate for this industry. In fact, we rarely have bag limits for fish caught by any means for any purpose. The aquarium fish industry is somewhat unique. Essentially, when the fishermen go out to catch fish, they're filling orders. There is an unlimited demand of aquarium fish, and they're not going to catch more than they can keep. Basically, the bag limits have been set based on the ability for the aquarium fishermen to collect and transport those fish. There are also other limits, but theoretically, I can't argue with the point that there are no bag limits, and therefore there's no limit to the number of fish that could potentially be caught. The reality is that industry essentially regulates itself because there's a limited demand for virtually all the fish that are caught, and that's what determines what the fishermen bring in every day.
Okay, so I want to play another clip from Earth Justice attorney Summer Kupau Odo, and this specifically regards the issue of sustainability of these fisheries.
They have not prepared a document or done a study that is anywhere near comparable to that required under the Environmental Policy Act. Its own reports, and looking back to 1998, the State of the Reefs report, there DLNR concluded that studies are necessary at that time if the aquarium collection is to continue. And more recently, in a report in 2015 to the legislature, it found that fish are significantly depleted in areas the trade operates. A number of species have failed to respond to the no-take areas established to protect them, and they have actually decreased since 1999.
So, Bruce, I'm looking at a report that the Department of Land and Natural Resources submitted to the legislature, state legislature, in 2015, and it shows an increase of 22% over the past 40 years in total catch. Earth Justice seems to be making the claim that we're not taking into consideration the overall populations of these fish. Is that an accurate statement, or is the department actively managing these the populations of these species being taken?
No, that's not an accurate statement, and I think they should know a lot better than that if they've ever looked at the data. We've collected data for over 17 years from over 6,700 surveys and found that aquarium fish populations are generally stable or increasing in West Hawaii, where slowly, which are the two most heavily collected species, are not declining. In recent years, they've both been increasing, both in the protected areas and in open areas. The reason they're increasing in all areas is because the protected areas, call them replenishment areas, there the fish are allowed to mature to a size where they can reproduce and spill over into other areas. So the abundance of these fish is actually increasing. What's, I think, being confused here, perhaps even intentionally, is that the resource fish, the fish that people are eating, are declining. There's no question that that's happening. We've had several reports over the last few weeks showing that that many of the resource fish are declining for various reasons, not the least of which is overfishing. But the aquarium fish, the fish that are the subject of this case, are really the data we have, and we have very good data on this. As I said, it was as good as anywhere in the world, shows that the fish populations are stable or increasing. Now, these are facts. There's no other data out there. I've heard that statement made numerous times, and no scientist that I've ever talked to can support that. It's surprising that it would come up with a statement like that. But again, let me emphasize that everything's not good. The resource fish, the fish that many of us think about and worry about when we go out fishing, the parrotfish, the papio, the oio, the fish that are popular for consumption are decreasing in abundance. And we're working on the plans to better manage those fisheries. But
specifically,
the aquarium trade is one of the few areas where there seems to be a very stable population, and if anything, the numbers are increasing.
So you would say that specifically with aquarium fish, the population and current practices are what could be considered sustainable?
No question. If you define sustainability as the numbers remaining the same and or increasing, then they're sustainable.
How will the DLNR move forward in light of the recent circuit court ruling?
Well, for the time being, until we finish the Chapter 43 process, essentially complete EIS, the industry is working on that. Fisheries, the use of small mesh nets is going to have a significant impact on the fishery. In fact, I expect most of the fishermen who are involved, those who are catching fish commercially, are probably not going to be able to sustain their livelihood catching these fish. When we finish that, we'll see what happens. We are looking at options. In fact, we've considered a bill that would license the fishermen, which would allow us to impose additional requirements on the fishermen as to the types of gear they use, how many fish they can catch, how they hold and sell the fish, and so forth. So I see a licensure program in the future if the industry is able to survive this this period, and that's essentially our plan. Of course, we are going to continue to monitor what's going on, and I think we'll continue to have an even better management program in place.
All right, Bruce Anderson from the Department of Land and Natural Resources, thank you so much for your time today.
Yeah, thanks for coming.
Bruce Anderson is the administrator of the Division of Aquatic Resources at the Hawaii Department of Land and Natural Resources, which is responsible for regulating the harvest of aquarium fish in Hawaii. You can find the department's 2015 report on the West Hawaii Fishery Management Area on the Conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org. This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up in the show, a self-effacing hero from Waianae takes us inside the world of the first responder. But first, your quiz.
Unihoa,
In today's backyard quiz, we're looking at a very small fish that's abundant in Hawaiian waters. It's a surgeon fish, Acanthurus triostigus, and it plays a critical role in the protection of coral reef systems. It feeds on algae that can choke the reef and keeps fast-growing seaweed from interfering with slow-growing coral. These little fish are found along most of Hawaii's shorelines and are recognizable by vertical stripes along their pale green or yellow body. They travel in large schools to ward off predators and further protect themselves with a razor-sharp spine near the tail. Their Hawaiian name is often used to mean small or insignificant, and today we're looking for both their English and Hawaiian names. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Inter Island Solar Supply, Kaiser Permanente, and Hastings and Pleadwell, a communication company.
Isaac Ho'opi'i was on the job as a canine police officer at the Pentagon on September 11, 2001. And when he heard the first explosion, his training kicked in. He ran into the burning building and was able to save lives through his quick actions. In the years since, Isaac has given a lot of thought to the mindset of first responders like himself. He's at the center of a new film showing at the Hawaii International Film Festival called Corridor 4, and we spoke with him about the day that changed his life.
The only thing not what goes through your mind, is how you're going to react,
right?
Especially with training, as well as everything that you put yourself in service, repetition.
Right.
Then when an incident do happen, you put all your tools together and see either you'll respond or, early, like I said, fight or flight.
Fight or flight, yeah.
Yeah, and your nervous system takes over, mm-hmm. Your adrenaline kicks in, all your endorphins mm-hmm. kick in, and you try to focus on just the incident itself.
Yeah. When what your responsibilities, that's where training kicks in, right?
Sure.
Training almost seems to allow you to go on a kind of automatic pilot. You function without stopping to think about everything you're doing. Is that an accurate description?
Yeah, because in a line of work, in any type of line of work, from first responders, I'm talking about EMTs, firefighters, or I'm speaking for law enforcement, we train for the worst scenario that would happen, and, nobody really thought
sure.
when you hit the building, but on the survival skills that you were training, you just let your body and mind take over.
Right.
Saving lives or what's the next move,
mm-hmm.
Getting the area safe. But as time went on, you start realizing, okay, were there biological, radioactive, chemical, that was involved? But just during that time, you were trained to serve and protect,
sure.
and save, or help out people.
So what were the first things that you saw? First things you heard, first things you saw?
Besides hearing a big explosion, the ground shook. I was only about 2 miles away, but after getting first officer on the scene, because, that's where I work at.
Right.
Being the first officer on the scene, all you can do when I pull my vehicle up, I run into the building, on the where the impact was, everything was moving slow motion.
Yeah.
of course, you see people just walking out with, you know, half of their clothes torn off, barefoot, or mainly, you know, people just ask, what happened? you've seen the windows blown out. And then, of course, you see that big fireball going. And then you just hear, you know, people, you know, calling out for help. And then that's when I just went straight to a person popped up, like, by a window. I just grabbed them, pulled them out.
Mm-hmm.
Took them about 25 yards. We started building, just dropping people in a safe area.
Right.
Like, and then they built that area like a triage.
Triage.
Yeah, when a lot of first medical teams started showing up.
Right.
But that's after, you know, going in the building several times, just trying to look for survivors.
Your task is to get people out of that building.
Sure, yeah.
And get them to the triage.
Correct. Even when the incident happened, you know, you get a call from my supervisor saying, hey, I'm giving a direct order, don't go in the building. You know, of course.
Yeah.
He was thinking, I think, the safety for all his teammates, you know, his officers. But in the same token, I mean, human nature just kicks in.
Yeah.
And
could you hear voices inside the building? You know, people calling out for help? And
yeah, it was, I don't want to say, you know, calling out for help, but it's just an eerie calling out, you know, last desperation on their lives, you know, calling out. So, I mean, you know, even though the incident happened during that time, I don't wish anybody go through the same experience. Now it's just how you cope and, you know, move forward. Some of the good things I love to share is, you know, talking about the incident because it's how we can prevent or see how we can move forward for big traumatic incidents like that.
Well, 9/11 got us thinking about first responders probably more than we ever had before because, you know, there was incredible heroism shown on that day. There were people ran into the building when people were running out.
Sure.
And that's, you've given a lot of thought since then to what happens in the mind of the first responder, which is not something I think had been given a lot of thought before. So much is expected of you as a first responder, right?
Sure. Especially as a law enforcement police officers, when they go into a gunfight, you know, one of the things that some of the protocols that we have set in place, you know, go on administrative leave. Now, you know, make sure that officers write up a statement, incident report. But nobody really took the time to find out the health and welfare on the person. Because, you know, he probably took somebody else's life.
Yeah.
And everybody reacts different. And then now he's going to be scrutinized because of whatever that incident happened.
Mm-hmm.
And now within the world, how you see things, you know, police officer shot a kid or, you know, or shooting somebody either with an arm. Unless you were there, everybody else can put their two cents in saying how it happened or what happened or this shouldn't be done and this amendment rights. But it's the same principle or concept when you have a traumatic event.
Well, very, very few people get the opportunity to have adrenaline take over and have training kick in with the intensity that you experienced or that, you know, a police officer experiences on a potentially deadly situation, right?
Correct.
That's kind of been your cause since 9/11.
Yeah, I mean, especially with how crime has changed in a different perspective now, besides, you know, years ago, how, you know, you're a police officer going up to somebody and you tell them, hey, what you're doing is wrong. But now it's unfortunate. Now the criminals are more, they're getting more intelligent, getting, you know, they're becoming more well-educated, where
better tools.
Yeah. But again, that's where the new interventions of new things coming out. So I've seen my agency grew so much from a law enforcement side to now security services / law enforcement and to different other avenues, what is used to intercept the, you know, terrorism and stuff.
Well, what are you doing for the whole phenomenon of essentially PTSD in first responders?
Well, as you know, Chris, we have this, you know, quarter four.
Right.
At first, when he created the two producers, Steve Trujillo and Maria Bissell, we started off as just a local boy being in, you know, nation's capital.
Right.
And, you know, helped on 9/11. You know, it was, I want to show on the positive side besides what happened in Washington, D.C., but the positive side that, you know, a local boy just did well for, you know, representing Hawaii.
Sure.
But as time went on, I did tell Steve, the producer, the director, say, hey, listen, you should talk to this officer. Talk to this officer. As time went on, he said, hey, Isaac, I think there's a little more twist to it than,
yeah.
And that's where, you know, a lot of them, I don't want to say they're getting depressed or going through some changes in their life, but
yeah.
I think my, not role, but to bring out there that people need to understand that within any type of traumatic event
right.
in your life, and it can be from a social worker as well as a regular individual working in administrative, you know, stress level can pick up real quick.
Sure.
Now, if you don't have some of the tools that you can have in place, and what we have, like I said, it's called a CINT program,
mm-hmm.
Crisis Intervention Negotiating Team and or peers group that we go out to help out some of these officers have personal, financial, even work issues. You can tell how the change of moods and
yeah.
And sometimes just talking and, or listening to what they have to vent.
Well, Isaac, given the blue-on-blue code, it has to be peers, is what you're saying.
I mean, yes, but, you know, as a supervisor, sometimes some right. officers won't come to, but when they do open up from another officer, hey, Sergeant Hoop, you need to talk to this person, because I said, all right, talk to him. If it's above my pay grade, but I know where they're heading to,
right.
then I would give them some references saying, hey, I think try to talk to the person. Doesn't have to be at work.
Uh-huh.
Take it outside so it's more personal. And, you know, of course we have the, you know, they have their own privacy, you know.
Yeah.
But if they don't share or talk to someone from that capacity,
yeah,
you know, that's where it starts building up and building up. So with quarter four, some of the officers that I got involved, I'm talking from the first line, the captain, lieutenant, even one of the officers, he got to share. He's retired, but even knowing what some of the changes he went through,
right.
it was nice that he could come up to me and just talk. I mean, and the best thing to do, you know, in this situation is just listen. Just listen and let him, you know, vent or share his, you know, experience.
And you've seen that do some good.
Oh, yeah. It was same with the guy I helped, Wayne Sinclair. He would call me every year, the individual I helped from 9/11. And just before the date of 9/11, he would call the day prior or day of. And we would talk, how's your family? How are you doing? What's going on? And then 10 minutes into the conversation, he goes right back of the incident, where he was, what he thought happened. You know, he would cry a little because, you know, I wouldn't be here right now and not see my grandkids. And I would just say, no, I understand. I hear what you're saying. You know, I'm glad you're here. Just real small
yeah.
talk on my side, but just let him vent. And every year so far, 16 years, I still hear from him every, you know, every anniversary.
Isaac Ho'opi'i was a canine police officer at the Pentagon on September 11, 2001. He was the first officer to run into the building and is credited with saving a number of lives. The film Corridor 4, which tells the story of Isaac's life in the aftermath of 9/11, is screening at the Hawaii International Film Festival this Saturday at 12:45 at the Toll Gannery Theater in Honolulu. You can find a link to the film's website on the Conversation Facebook page.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, whose Kidney Cars program provides funding for community health and education services. Learn more about vehicle donation at kidneyhi.org.
Few issues at the upcoming legislative session are likely to stir more argument and more emotion than a measure to regulate the practice of midwifery. Measures to regulate midwives have met heated opposition at least four times before at the legislature, and this year it's the midwives themselves who are driving the initiative. Reporter Courtney Teague has more in today's Civil Beat Reality Check. Good morning.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me on.
Sure, Courtney. This is a story that's going to generate a lot of heat on all sides, isn't it?
Yeah, it's definitely a very, very passionate issue, to say the least.
Who's driving this? As I said earlier, the midwives themselves are looking at some self-regulating. Is that accurate?
Right. So there's a professional organization here in Hawaii called the Midwives Alliance of Hawaii, and they are leading the push for legislation. They're drafting something. They've been working with physicians, legislators, other stakeholders. Right now, we are only looking at regulating a couple types of nationally certified non-nurse midwives. So that's midwives that do not have a nursing degree, and they usually perform home births, not in-hospital births.
Is this an attempt on the part of that association to sort of maybe stave off more severe regulation that might come externally?
No, that's not really my understanding. The arguments for are really, it boils down to patient safety. So
right.
In 2015, we know that 340 babies were born out of the hospital. So that's about 2% of all babies. And while it is rare, injuries and even deaths do occasionally occur from home births. And there's also some speculation that this could help midwives get access to emergency medications. So if something goes wrong, like a woman starts hemorrhaging, that could help with that. They could also possibly be considered as care providers. So in the event of an emergency transfer, they're able to talk about a patient's medical history with that emergency room physician. And there is also some speculation that it could help midwives be covered under health plans.
The current climate for midwives is one, as it says, and as your headline, Subit headline says, there are more regulations in industries like manicurists and bartenders than a midwife faces today, right?
Yeah, sure. And that's not true for all midwives. Again, nurse midwives, they are actually quite regulated by the state because they are considered nurses.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, for many of the midwives that are performing home births, there's just no real way to keep tabs on what they're doing.
So that leaves an enormous vulnerability. It sounds as if that's what this association is looking to forestall, yeah?
Yeah, it does. But, of course, there's lots of women who feel it's about women's rights, reproductive freedoms, the right to choose who you give birth with, how you give birth, where you give birth. And people just don't want the state involved in that. I mean, understandably. Plus, with midwifery, there's been a long history of apprenticeship training. So currently, under the legislation that they are drafting, there would be no room for those women in this plan. And also, they say a lot of women just don't feel comfortable in the hospital where there are much higher rates of medical interventions like cesarean sections or induced labor.
Sure.
Although with home births, there is a slightly higher rate of death. It's about twice as high compared to hospital births.
We're going to be hearing some heated debate if this advances at the legislature. Thanks very
Definitely.
Much, Courtney.
Yeah, thank you.
Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat, today featuring reporting fellow Courtney Teague.
Support for today's programming comes from the BIA Hawaii's 2017 Summit, Still Houseless in Hawaii. Examining ways to address Hawaii's housing shortage, November 14th at Pomaika'i Ballroom, biahawaii.org.
We live in a world that seems to be advancing in its understanding of gender fluidity as transgender celebrities take a more visible place in popular culture. And in Virginia, they elect an openly transgender state representative. Every trend has its backlash, though. At least 25 transgender people were murdered last year in this country, and the nation's chief executive has called for their exclusion from the military. We asked Amy Gregg, an instructor in the Gender and Women's Studies program at UH Hilo, to help us sort out what's going on.
Well, I think we got where we are today in terms of multiple gender identities by people gradually recognizing that gender is more complicated than what most of us were told as we were growing up. Most of us grew up being told that there are two sexes, male and female, mm-hmm. which is a binary construction. And in recent decades, the term gender has been used sort of interchangeably with the term sex mm-hmm. to designate male or female. But in sociology and in feminism and a lot of contemporary discussions, the term gender is used to refer to a variety of things, not just whether we're designated male or female, but to refer to social expectations about being male or female. And then gradually there was the realization that there isn't just our external designation when we're born, but there's our internal sense of identity, regardless of how we've been assigned. And then there's also the external performance, our clothes, our behavior, true. Those kinds of things. And so gradually the theory has involved these several different aspects of gender rather than just, oh, you have these genitalia, you're this.
Well, you know, people who grew up in the 50s, as I did, Amy, boys were directed toward G.I. Joe, girls mm-hmm. were directed toward Barbie. And if you didn't feel directed in one of those two areas appropriate to what that was designated appropriate to your gender, you felt a little strange about it. You, mm-hmm. you didn't belong, right?
Right. So everything was supposed to line up. Those who were assigned male, those who were designated as male when they were born were expected to look and feel and behave masculine. Mm-hmm. So the masculine is the term for all those social expectations about what a male is supposed to
right.
do and think and feel. And that's constructed as being the complete opposite of what it means to be feminine. So we get this binary construction that's these two opposites.
Well, a lot of people on both sides of that equation felt uncomfortable with those designations, right?
Right. Even those of us who basically identify with our assignment don't feel like we completely fit into the category that we've been placed in
sure.
a lot of times.
Well,
so in recent years, the term cisgender has developed for those who do agree with their gender assignment. That's CIS gender.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the opposite of transgender, which is those who do not agree with how they were assigned in one way or another. Transgender, transgender is an umbrella term that encompasses a lot of different categories, but basically has to do with crossing from one to the other, which again gets back to a binary because if you're crossing from one to another, it implies two. And many people who are transgender want to get rid of the binaries and say there's a whole spectrum of areas in between.
Well, I agreed, but, you know, when I first heard the term binary, I thought, well, that doesn't apply because there's all kinds of different ways to be male. There's all kinds of different ways to be female. I mean, I never thought of it as binary. On a simplified level, it's presented that way to us, but, mm-hmm. you know, most of us figure out that there are an awful lot of ways to fit into that designation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if we stop and think about it, and if we're self-aware and aware of others around us, but many of the messages that we get are very strictly binary.
No, that's
of course,
true.
If we think about the people we know, there's a wide spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, what gender theorists emphasize is that there's much more variety amongst all males and amongst all females than there is difference between a representative male and a representative female.
It would seem to be a pretty healthy trend to be getting away from that. What are the ways in which the trend is manifesting itself?
So what some people are doing these days is emphasizing a variety of identities that try to break down the binary and using terms to indicate that they don't agree with the binary and they don't see themselves as fitting in that.
Mm-hmm.
So there are several terms that people use gender neutral, gender queer, agender, gender fluid. Those are some of the main ones. And then there are issues around pronouns and not wanting to be designated by the standard binary he, she pronouns. So many people who don't identify with the binary also don't want to be to have those pronouns used about them. And many of them prefer they as a neutral pronoun, which confuses a lot of people because it's a plural.
Exactly.
It doesn't sound like a singular.
Exactly, yeah.
But the attempts to construct a new singular pronoun haven't really caught on in the wider community, in the wider public. There have been attempts to have words like Z, which is spelled S-I-E, or another version is Z-E, but those haven't caught on widely.
I can't imagine that they would, to tell you the truth. I saw an article from France in which, of course, the French language, everything is le or la, right?
Mm-hmm, right.
Masculin ou féminin. And,
of
course, they're particularly upset about the linguistic changes that this whole philosophy brings about.
Right. And Sweden has come up with a third pronoun that's gender neutral. But I haven't heard any reports about how it's doing there.
It's affecting people across the nation in ways much, much deeper than a designation, isn't it?
Yes, it is, certainly. We've got all the bathroom issues, for example.
Well, and I've wondered since that came about, what on earth is so upsetting about, the possibility you run into a transgender person in the bathroom?
I have no idea. Our bathrooms at home are multi-gender bathrooms.
Exactly.
So I'm not sure why we get so hung up in public.
But it's become a statewide issue in a couple of southern states.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes, that's right.
And we just had a transgender person get elected to a statewide office for, I think, the first time on record.
Yes, and replacing someone who wanted to exclude transgenders from their designated bathrooms and the bathrooms that they want to use. So that was nice justice.
Do you see this as a positive trend? Are you hopeful for the, adding to our understanding of one another in the future?
I do think it's a positive trend because I think the more that we can break down categories and pigeonholes that people get put in and the more freedom that people can have to be themselves and to incorporate a wide variety of human characteristics, and the more we can recognize that these are human traits and behaviors, not strictly masculine or feminine, the better it is for everybody.
Amy Gregg is an instructor in the Gender and Women's Studies program at the University of Hawaii at Hilo. In today's backyard quiz, we asked you about a species of surgeon fish that's commonly found in Hawaiian waters. They can be seen along the shoreline, grazing on the reef and feeding on algae and seaweed. They serve a vital service by keeping in check the seaweed that can inhibit coral growth. The name surgeon fish comes from a razor-sharp spine near the tail, helps them discourage predators. When they're young, they usually make their home in tide pools, and when they mature, they form schools and move into deeper waters and along the reef. That's when they develop the vertical stripes that both identify them and offer some degree of camouflage. Some people say the stripes look like vintage prison wear, and that's the source of their common English name, convict tang. But most of them know them by their Hawaiian name, manini, and Rick Wilson, a diver from Kona, knew them by both names. He's today's winner. And that's today's quiz. If you've got one, you can send it to TalkBack at HawaiiPublicRadio.org. Today's surfboards are made out of hazardous materials, and that's an issue in a culture and an industry that prides itself on its care for the natural environment. HPR reporter Kuve Hiraishi has been looking into what some surfers are doing to address that apparent contradiction. And Cuvée's with me in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning, Chris.
That was the first thing I thought of anyway, Cuvée. You know, it was like, this is surfing is all about care for the ocean, sustainable values, all that. And here they are with what kind of materials in those boards?
Exactly. Lovers of the ocean are riding our waves on 100% toxic material, which is, you know, you don't think about it in that context, but a group of surfers are trying to raise awareness about this. So we're talking about petrochemicals. We've got a polyurethane foam that's at the core of these, and you've got resin over that that's also based from that same material, and then you've got fiberglass over that. So none of it is, it's going to last longer than we humans will.
Nothing biodegrades.
Nothing biodegrades. And we see this, I think, here in Hawaii. If you go anywhere near any surf spot, you see a snap board in the trash can. Some folks try to get creative and make artwork out of it. I think I went into the Modern Honolulu Hotel.
Right.
They actually reused all these, repurposed all these broken boards into this artwork installation because you can't do anything with it once it snaps. You really can't.
Yeah. And they snap a lot.
They do. So according to the surfboard manufacturing industry, we look at about 400,000 boards, surfboards, being produced every year. And of that, any surfer who's surfed anywhere can attest to having a broken board.
Sure.
I don't know if with the professional surfers, they probably break a lot more than the average surfer. So all these boards end up going into the landfill, which is sort of one other aspect of the toxicity of this board.
We've heard a lot of concern in recent years about things like food containers.
Exactly. Foam, all these.
Grocery bags.
Exactly.
Anything biodegradable that might end up in the ocean or in the landfill has been an object of concern. Surfboards have sort of escaped.
They have. And the folks I got to speak to, so Cliff Capono is a surfer and also a scientist. And he's from Hilo. And he told me that, you know, he's worked with folks who have been working with different sort of materials, biodegradable materials. So we're talking about tree saps. I think there are some manufacturers who are working with hemp cloth and flaxseed cloth instead of fiberglass. And so these are materials that are coming and being extracted from bio content, if you will, and put into the boards. But at this point, we're not quite... The economies of scale aren't there to allow for a full 100% eco board.
Yeah.
So what they're trying to do is sort of chip away at that 100% toxicity. So some of the boards that they work with that they are putting out right now are 25% recyclable polyurethane or 25% of this bio content. You know, so we're taking baby steps towards it. It's not the solution just yet, but we're working towards it, is what they're saying.
Well, baby steps, because what you're talking about is upending an extremely profitable industry.
Exactly. And I got to also, for this piece, talk to Maddie Rayner, one of the shapers, surfboard shapers over on the North Shore. And from his perspective as a shaper, he would love to be working with these materials, but the demand from the surfers, from the consumers, from the end user, is not quite at that level where they're asking for it at a, you know, in high demand. So what Maddie and Cliff Capono and also our guy Kahi Pakaro, the executive director for Sustainable Coastlines Hawaii, is trying to do is incentivize folks to use these boards. So we do have I did get to speak to Kahi earlier this week, and he kind of gave us an idea of what they're trying to do.
Issue is the pros aren't adopting eco boards quickly enough. So we wanted to incentivize our elite surfers to start trying these technologies so that the average surfer will follow suit. With more demand for eco boards, we can start pushing economies of scale to make eco boards more affordable. And in addition, create the incentive for companies and people in their garages to start experimenting with technologies that make boards even better than these ones.
So what Kahi's talking about is something called the protest. Now, it's a double entendre, but it's a protest against the conventional surfboard. But it is also an opportunity for professional surfers to test out eco boards. So what they did was got a few shapers together, over a dozen shapers participated to create these eco boards. And like I said, they're chipping away at the 100% toxicity. So these are not completely biodegradable boards. Yeah. They've got a little bit in there. And what they're doing is offering them to pro surfers this winter season over on the North Shore to test out the boards and then to videotape that, upload their surf clips. I know any surfer who's a surfer here in Hawaii can spend endless hours watching these pro surfers
yes, they can.
Riffing on these waves. And so they're trying to get these guys more incentive to sort of try out an eco board themselves.
This is going to be an interesting story to follow, Kuvei. Thanks very much for taking the time.
Yes.
Kuvei Hiraishi is HPR's General Assignment Reporter. You can find her story on environmentally friendly surfboards at hawaiipublicradio.org under the General News tab.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Bush Consulting, Sacred Hearts Academy, and Urgent Care Hawaii.
And that's it for this week. Coming up next week on The Conversation, monster homes may be coming to a community near you. We want to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments or suggest a story idea. That number is 808-792-8217. You also can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Both the phone number and email address are posted on the conversation page of hawaiipublicradio.org. If you missed part of the conversation, you can find them all on the HPR app. Search for HPR in the Apple App Store or on Google Play. This program is produced by Lillian Song, Ryan Finnerty, and Amber Kahn. Our intern is Emily Cardinelli. The Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. I'm Chris Vandercook. Join us Monday and pick up the conversation.